DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello, I'm Irene Quayle in Bonn. Good to have you with us.
We want to stand with the Mundurucu people and have the Brazilian government formally recognise their land and their claim to the land, because they've traditionally occupied it for generations, and to prevent this huge hydro dam from being built in this area, which will destroy or threaten the unique biodiversity of the area and threaten the Mundurucu's livelihoods and way of life.
The Olympic Games are taking place in Brazil, but not everybody feels like celebrating, including many of the country's indigenous population. And in Canada too, First Nations people are fighting for their land.
Imagine to have in the center of this capital a place in harmony and beauty, and a place where you can feel that power of being in harmony with each other and in harmony with the environment. That would be something the rest of the world would envy.
But on the whole, the world's population is not taking good care of the planet's limited natural resources.
The amount of nature we use from January 1st till August 8th is as much as Earth can renew in the entire year. So it's like if we had already spent all our money by August 8th for the entire year.
Coming up on this edition of Living Planet. Brazil is in the headlines this week with the Olympic Games taking place. Representatives of the country's indigenous peoples, some of whom live in the depths of the country's Amazon forests, have been among those carrying the torch. But behind this positive image of a multi-ethnic country, indigenous leaders have drawn attention to injustices. With the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples coming up on August the 9th, Living Planet pays a visit to the Mundurucu indigenous people. They are resisting hydroelectric dams on the Tapajós River, a major tributary of the Amazon. The hydropower, supposedly a green form of energy, would destroy forests and could even increase greenhouse gas emissions. Ruby Russell has the story.
The Mundurucu have lived in villages in the Amazon's Tapajós River Valley for centuries. From their first contact with Europeans in the mid-1700s, they gained a reputation as fearsome warriors, which might just have helped them preserve their traditional way of life to this day. But all this is now at risk. The Mundurucu have a new fight on their hands. The Brazilian government plans to build a hydropower dam at São Luís do Tapajós, which would flood their forest home. Indigenous leader Geraldo Crixi Mundurucu has problems sleeping at night.
The river, as well as the forest, is like our mother. The animals in the forest don't know what is coming, if it's good or bad. Therefore, we want to protect them, to protect the river. Then we could live in peace and be happy. If the river Tapajós is dammed, how are we going to survive?
If the dam goes ahead, an area the size of New York City will be inundated. Jeremy Campbell, an environmental anthropologist at Roger Williams University in the United States, has worked in the Tapajós region since 1999. He says the Mundurucu's entire way of life is under threat.
If the dam were built, the Mundurucu villages in the middle Tapajós region would no longer be able to live in a traditional way. They'd have to go to the city. They'd have to be forced, essentially, to lose touch with their identity. And this is not something that the Mundurucu will, in my view, ever accept.
The Brazilian constitution guarantees permanent ownership of lands traditionally occupied by indigenous peoples, including exclusive use of soil resources, rivers and lakes within the area. But the territory inhabited by the Mundurucu in this part of Brazil's Pará state has not been recognised by the federal government, and the Mundurucu people were never consulted about the construction of the dam. They have long fought for official demarcation of the Saure-Muibu indigenous territory, an area of 178,000 hectares. Now, facing the destruction of their land, indigenous leaders have started to demarcate it themselves.
Yes.
The Dajé Kapap IP village has just erected a demarcation sign, very similar to the official one, Crixie explains.
Whoever comes here and sees this sign will know this piece of land belongs to us, the Munduruku.
The Tapajós River still flows freely for 800 kilometres through Brazil's Mato Grosso Amazonas and Pará states. But the Brazilian Energy Research Company plans to build 7 dams in the Tapajós Basin by 2024. And it's not just the Munduruku and their traditional way of life that are at risk. The dam would flood thriving ecosystems, including critical habitats for animals such as the ocelot, howler monkey, and pink river dolphin, along with numerous bird, lizard, and amphibian species. More than 300 species of fish in the region could also be impacted. That's why environmental groups are supporting the Munduruku struggle, as Bunny McDermid, co-executive director of Greenpeace International, explains.
We want to stand with the Munduruku people and have the Brazilian government formally recognise their land and their claim to the land because they've traditionally occupied it for generations, and to prevent this huge hydro dam from being built in this area, which will destroy or threaten the unique biodiversity of the area and threaten the Munduruku's livelihoods and way of life.
Infrastructure around dam construction also contributes to deforestation, as it opens up access for logging, livestock ranching and agribusiness. Paulo Odario is one of the founders of Greenpeace Brazil. He says the life of the forest and its people go hand in hand.
There's no more room for fossil energy resources or those that bring environmental impacts like deforestation or go against the right of traditional people.
Greenpeace also points out that although hydropower doesn't burn fossil fuels or emit carbon, it can be responsible for another climate harmful gas, methane. Studies have shown that dams, especially in the tropics, release large amounts of methane due to rotting vegetation in flooded areas. Brazil's Ministry of Mines and Energy argues that the hydropower is important for the country's development. The São Luís do Tapajós Dam would contribute 8,000 megawatts of generation capacity. That would also allow Brazil to develop a waterway for exports from Mato Grosso state to Asia through the Panama Canal. Mato Grosso is the largest soybean producer in Brazil, and its main buyer is China. But big economic plans haven't trumped the environment or indigenous ways of life yet. The Brazilian Institute of Environment and Natural Resources has suspended the hydropower project's environmental license until the National Indigenous Foundation has assessed the situation. Everything now hangs on a decision to be made in the capital of Brasilia. And with the fate of the Tapajós at stake, the Munduruku aren't waiting quietly. Anthropologist Jeremy Campbell says the Munduruku are no strangers to adversity. He first came to the region 17 years ago, at a time of explosive land grabbing. Then the Munduruku faced violence, but they weren't easily intimidated, and they won't be now.
The Munduruku are an incredibly united people, and they are a warrior people. They use that word. They say that that we're at war. They are at war. They consider this a war.
28-year-old Antonio Dashe Munduruku is one of the villagers who has taken that modern-day war, as he describes it, all the way to Brasilia.
People who live in the capitals and abroad, in the developed countries, they look at the Amazon as an empty space, as green area only, and everyone wants a piece of it. Therefore, our rights are threatened.
Dashe, a father of two, says he wants his family to continue to live their traditional way of life. Preserving their culture might not just be a gift to the next generation of Munduruku, but to the future of our planet.
I want to be indigenous, to live an indigenous life. If we don't have this right, we'll be extinct. Pressure comes from everywhere. Many people talk about climate and the role of forests, but we are the people who really preserve the forest.
Ruby Russell presented that report, filed for Living Planet by Brazilian correspondent Nadia Pontes. In Canada, too, Indigenous peoples are fighting for their rights and their land. One of those conflicts is playing out virtually on the doorstep of the country's parliament in the capital, Ottawa. There are over 600 First Nations or Aboriginal communities in Canada. 10 of them are Algonquin. The Algonquin people revere a sacred site located on a cluster of islands just a couple of kilometres upstream from Ottawa, which is destined for a major development project. Recently, hundreds of Algonquin people and their supporters marched through the streets of downtown Ottawa to bring their message to Parliament. Sian Griffiths met with protesters as well as the developer to find out what's so special about this land.
The pounding of the drum, the heartbeat of Mother Earth, resonates all around us here on Victoria Island in the Ottawa River. Gathered Algonquin are humming and swaying to the beat of the drum. It's a deeply powerful moment of communion. Elder Albert Dumont has been offering protesters a smouldering bundle of dried sage in a ceremony known as smudging. People draw in the sweet smoke with their hands as if to bathe themselves.
And it's a purification. A person who will bring it towards themselves will acknowledge their place in the cycle of life, that a human being came last, and the purpose of a human being is to heap praise on everything that was here to help the human beings live. It's a purification ceremony. It's an opportunity for a human being to give, to acknowledge thanksgiving.
Elder Evelyn Commanda recites a prayer in Algonquin. People are clearly overwhelmed with emotion. It's not often Algonquin get to hear their own language, a lasting impact of the success of a policy to stamp out their cultural heritage at government-run boarding schools. Only about 20% speak it today. Just a few decades ago, many of these practices were banned by Canadian authorities. Albert Dumont explains the inextricable link between Aboriginal spirituality and the land.
Creator created all things. We believe that our ancestors sang an honor song for everything, that in the circle of life, something that might appear to be worthless was there for a reason, a worm or a bug, an ant or something needed it to be there.
Victoria Island is a public space, but the two other nearby islands, Chaudière and Albert, have long been in private hands, concreted over with buildings now fallen into disuse, a reminder of the island's recent industrial history. It was once one of the world's most important hubs for the production of pulp and paper as well as matchsticks. Adjacent to Chaudière Island were once visually breathtaking and thunderous falls, celebrated in art and poetry in the days when they ran freely. Over a century ago, a dam was built to harness the power of the falls to drive industry on the islands. This greatly diminished the roar and splendor of the falls. Industrialization spurred prosperity in what was to become Canada's capital city, but to Indigenous people, these islands have been special for thousands of years. They, like all of Ottawa, are known as unceded Algonquin territory, never conquered by the Europeans or surrendered by a treaty. Douglas Cardinal, a world-renowned Indigenous architect, is one of the organizers of the protest. He compares the falls to a natural cathedral.
You know, it was like an act of the Creator who created these powerful falls and then had created a whirlpool shaped like a sacred pipe with a mist coming out of the center and the water going deep into the earth to remind us how we're connected to the earth.
Carleton University researchers have recently confirmed the presence of 5,000-year-old Indigenous burial grounds downstream from the islands, putting the islands at the center of a spiritually significant Indigenous site. Cardinal feels it's time for the islands to be returned to Algonquin control.
We want to decolonize these islands like we're decolonizing ourselves now. Before it was illegal to have these beautiful ceremonies to connect us with the Creator.
In 1950, city planners called for the islands to become a public parkland after their industrial days were over. Elder William Commander, a revered spiritual leader of the Algonquin people until his death 5 years ago, dreamed of a place he called Assinapka, a sort of sanctuary for indigenous people, but which would be open to the public. He imagined the old industrial site being converted into a parkland, with a large forest, a place to grow traditional medicines like tobacco, sage, cedar, and sweetgrass, while the falls would again flow freely. He hoped the Victoria Island would become home to an indigenous cultural center and a peace center open to all of the world's faiths. He thought this plan would be compatible with that of the city planners, but would at the same time give the Algonquin people a spiritual home. Douglas Cardinal worked alongside Elder Commander to help him realize his vision, at least on paper.
Imagine to have in the center of this capital a place in harmony and beauty, and a place where you can feel that power of being in harmony with each other and in harmony with the environment. That would be something the rest of the world would envy.
Elder Commander dedicated much of his life to lobbying politicians to make his dream a reality. He was an international figure who met with Nelson Mandela, the Dalai Lama, and the Queen. He's still held in high regard by his people, many of whom are wearing pins with his image today. In 2011, the lands were put up for sale, but no Canadian authority stepped in to bring them into public hands. Instead, they were sold to Windmill, one of Canada's leading sustainable developers. They say their aim is to build a community powered by hydro, where waste would be entirely recycled and transport would be geared to walking, cycling, and public transport, all geared to reducing the carbon footprint to zero. Its CEO is Jeff Westind.
It'll be a complete community. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, everything you need to survive within a kilometre of your house. So that you no longer need a car.
While a fifth of the land will be publicly accessible green space, the rest will be a mix of condominiums and retail space.
The fact is that we will lose a sacred site because condominiums and sacredness just do not mix.
Westheim says he's reached out to the Algonquin people to consult with them about the development, but just one official First Nation, Pickwakanagan, responded to the invitation to collaborate. Its chief has lauded the development as precedent-setting and landmark opportunity for a new model of collaboration. But the vast majority of Algonquin First Nations oppose the project. Indeed, the Assembly of First Nations, which represents Canada's First Nations peoples, also oppose it. They say their prior and informed consent hasn't been given. This is a key plank of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which Canada recently said it would adopt. First Nation chiefs have called on the government to consult immediately over the issue of the planned development of the islands. The Canadian government has told Living Planet.
It is our hope that the parties involved, including the Windmill Development Group, local municipalities, the Algonquins of Quebec, and the Algonquins of Ontario, can work together to find a constructive, respectful, and positive way forward.
The government, for now, doesn't see a role for itself in this issue on its doorstep. But Algonquin activists say they plan to keep up the pressure through further protests and will take this case all the way to the Supreme Court if needed. As for the falls, they will remain under that concrete dam, according to the power company which operates them. But a new upgrade will make them accessible to the public via a small, but indigenously inspired, public space. Shan Griffiths for DW in Ottawa.
While Indigenous people are often described as guardians of our natural environment, the rest of us don't seem to be making a very good job of using our resources sustainably. The Global Footprint Network keeps track of how we're doing, and this year it tells us Earth Overshoot Day falls on Monday, August the 8th. I called up the co-founder and CEO of the Global Footprint Network, Mattis Wackernagel, at his home in California. First, I asked him to sum up exactly what is meant by our ecological footprint.
The ecological footprint is a very simple accounting system that looks at the world from a physical perspective, a bit like a farmer. So on the one hand, we measure how much area do we have that is ecologically productive, or in other ways, we could say, how big is our farm as a country or as a region or as the world? And then we can compare that with our footprint, which measures how much area is needed to produce everything that I depend on, like my orange juice, my potatoes, my cotton, to absorb the CO2 from my fossil fuel burning, to accommodate the cities that we live in, etc. So we can compare human demand for nature with how much nature is available.
You mentioned CO2. When we talk about the ecological footprint, how does that fit into it as a whole?
The carbon footprint is becoming an ever bigger part of the ecological footprint these days. But if we follow Paris' goal to stay within 2 degrees Celsius, we would need to be with a zero carbon footprint by 2050. So the essential idea is that the limiting factor that we face is the Earth's ability to renew. And so we have competing uses for that renewal capacity. One is for food, but then also if you want to accommodate, or if you don't want to increase the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, we need to put space aside for carbon sequestration, to build forests, for example, to sequester the extra CO2. So these are all competing uses. Currently, the carbon footprint makes up over 60% of humanity's ecological footprint.
Wow, that's a pretty big percentage.
Our economy is built very heavily on running on fossil fuels. And I think that's the big challenge that we face now, that finally, since December 12th, 2015, we have agreed that moving over 2 degrees Celsius is an unacceptable target for humanity. And that translates in very clear physical constraints that we would need to face in order not to do that.
So what would that mean in practice?
In practice, I mean, it's a very simple calculation. If we want to live up to the targets to which we agreed in Paris, we would have to move out of fossil fuel use very, very quickly.
Let's come to August the 8th. August the 8th, you tell us, is Earth Overshoot Day. What exactly does that mean?
Correct. It translates our results in something that is more easy to visualize. So it says the amount of nature we use from January 1st till August 8th is as much as Earth can renew in the entire year. So it's like if we had already spent all our money by August 8th for the entire year.
So how do you work that out?
I mean, the principles are very simple. We use UN statistics to add up all the various demands of humanity for food, fiber, energy, etc. And we translate that into area needed to renew these amounts. And then we compare that with how much air is available on the planet that can renew these material flows. And so we get a ratio between how much we use and how much we have. And currently, we use from nature about 60% faster materials and energy than can be renewed.
So where do we stand on that in 2016 compared to previous years? Have we got better or have we got worse?
Globally, Overshoot is slightly higher this year than it was last year, according to our preliminary data. Not all data are in, so it's a bit of an estimate, but it seems that we haven't really turned around the trend. So the increase is slower than perhaps 10, 15 years ago, but it's still an increase. Even if we decreased Overshoot, you cannot stay in Overshoot at that level for very, very long.
So presumably, if we keep overshooting, eventually there will be nothing left, right? Or is it the case that we can keep overusing our resources without actually noticing what's happening until it's more or less too late?
It's a little bit like with money. If you have a lot of assets, you can overspend for quite a while. And nature does have quite a few assets. So the consequences are not too immediate. And they're also often distant. So one aspect is how much CO2 we can emit. Then there are other consequences as well, as overusing freshwater, overusing fisheries, etc. Since we live in a globalized world and I live in a country or I live in a region that has a very high income, we can get food from distant places. So we don't necessarily see or feel the overuse directly in our lives when we are shielded by high incomes. But the question is, will we always have the income advantage to get those extra resources? For example, Switzerland, where I grew up, and it's not that different for Germany, its relative income compared to the rest of the world is vanishing because China, for example, or India has higher growth rates. That means, relatively speaking, the Swiss are taking home a smaller and smaller percentage of the global income pie. So what does that mean? If, relatively speaking, Switzerland doesn't earn as much as compared to others, it may become also more difficult in the long run to get the extra resources from elsewhere.
But if we look not only at countries like Germany and Switzerland, from the point of view of justice and equality, it seems fair to say that developing countries will be saying, you lot have to cut down first, we still need to expand.
I mean, in the end, it's a risk measure. I'm saying, what can we afford? I mean, of course, everybody wants to have better lives and everybody should have the right to better lives. That's what we also committed to with the Sustainable Development Goals. And then we also have to do it in a way that doesn't ruin us. So, for example, like some countries are in very difficult positions. India, for example, has very, very little biocapacity in its own country and a lower income. And their demand already now exceeds what they have available in their own country by twofold. So that makes them extremely vulnerable. So yes, I think it would be fantastic for everybody to have great lives. And at the same time, if we drive a development pattern that is very resource intensive, we put ourselves and we put particularly lowest income people at risk first, because we build a development or we build progress that we won't be able to maintain.
So if our listeners here to Living Planet want to do something to mark Earth Overshoot Day and make their own little contribution, have you any ideas for what they should be doing?
There's so many things we can do. We have a website, overshootday.org, where we ask people to make pledges as a way to kind of participate and see and try out certain things that are possible to do in our own personal lives. We make a number of tools available. There's like personal calculators where people can play around with their own lifestyle and find out how that affects their own footprint. We have whole data sets where you can compare countries. That could also lead then in your conversations about what kind of a country do we want to live in? What kind of policies does your country need to drive in order to make your lives more secure and better? So the information is all available. I think we still operate as if we could expand infinitely, but it ultimately will bite us.
Mattis Vakkernagel, co-founder and CEO of the Global Footprint Network.
What about sunrise? What about rain? What about all the things that you said we were to gain? What about killing fields? Is there a time?
And I'm afraid we've used up our time budget on Living Planet for this week, and there's no scope for any overshooting. Remember, you can download episodes of the programme or individual reports or replay them online at dw.com/environment. You'll also find more information there on this week's stories, and you can catch up on some of the other environment stories which made the news this week and some of the ones which didn't get into the headlines. You can also listen to DW Living Planet stories on iTunes and on SoundCloud. We'd love to hear your thoughts and comments on the programme by email to livingplanet@dw.com or via Twitter to DW_eco. I'm Irene Quayle from all of us here in Bonn. Until next time, thanks for listening and bye for now.
What have we done to the world? Look what we've done. What about all the peace that you pledged your only son? Did you ever stop to notice all the children dead from war?